Well, thank you very much for having me here today, and thank you also for teaching me how to make a pudding, Madeline, wherever Madeline might be. I had a Scottish grandmother who used to bake a plum duff every Christmas. I think that might have been a bit of a family name for a Scottish Christmas pudding. Granny's Clootie Dumpling is another term for it. Now, the Scots are stingy, and the ingredients that are in Granny's Clootie Dumpling is basically flour, some treacle, about a third of the amount of fruit that goes into an English pudding, and that's pretty much it. And I was quite amazed the first year I made it, when Nana taught me how to do it, to find that it actually works. But I do think that the rich English puddings are something of a treat in themselves. So I'm very pleased to know how to make one now, and my mum is going to be very pleased that I've already made the Christmas pudding for this year, because she's not a fan of making pudding. So it's all worked out now. And thank you also for having me here to speak to you today. I want to share with you a talk which is hoping to help you to see how Christmas is actually founded in history, and that the Christian claims of Christmas are founded in history. That's why I called it "The Proof is in the Pudding," because I think the Christmas events are things that can be proven. Now, I'm just going to kind of rearrange the place just a little bit, hopefully without knocking over the water too much, because there's a PowerPoint presentation, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to swivel a little bit, because I'm assuming that what's behind me here is matching what I'm saying, and I might just have to check from time to time. And the other miracle will be if this little pointy thing actually works, because I haven't used one before, so we'll see how we go. Now, that passage that we looked at before is taken from Matthew's Gospel in the Bible, and I'll be referring to that. Hopefully there'll be passages printed up on the screen, so you'll be able to see bits that I'm particularly referring to. But Matthew was one of Jesus' followers. He was a disciple, and he was an eyewitness to many of the events of Jesus' life. He was there at that period of time, and we can hear him speaking and telling us about what happened. Now, of course, he wasn't actually there at Jesus' birth, because disciples tend to be about the same age or younger than the teacher they're following, so obviously he was being born about the same time as Jesus was. But they checked their stories with those who had been there, and most of the things that are written in the Bible are eyewitness events to what has happened. And so we have an eyewitness event here to the first Christmas in history, and I wanted us just to spend some time thinking about that today. Because Christmas time is a special time, isn't it? I think for many of us it is, and I think that's because of memories of Christmases gone by. I have certainly always loved the lead up to Christmas, because my family, well, really my mother, made preparing Christmas so much fun. There was decorating the house, we went over the top with paper chains and the big Christmas tree, and every room in the house had some sort of Christmas decoration, and as kids we loved helping to do that. We'd go shopping in town and see all the decorations in town and the lights. We'd write Christmas cards. I'd go over to my grandmother's house to help cook the pudding. It was all great fun. I loved every moment of it. But a very dominant memory in particular is the Christmas specials that used to be on television in the mornings during December, once the school holidays came. Now, I got pretty excited because I'd watched them year after year until they stopped being shown on television, or I was too old to watch them anymore. And then only last year, some of these shows started being released on DVD, and I got a bit nostalgic and I bought up a few. I have them here. These are my favourites. Does anyone remember Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or Frosty the Snowman, or The Little Drummer Boy? I used to love watching these every single year. It was part of the Christmas tradition for me. Who can go past the story of that magical snowman who cheers up the children at Christmas time, or that reindeer who helps out Santa on that foggy Christmas Eve, or the little boy with the gift of drumming for Jesus? My Christmases just wouldn't have been the same without these stories, I don't think. They were a lot of fun. But Christmas memories can become so crowded, can't they? These Christmas traditions can become a bit like Christmas barnacles. Like growths on the bottom of boats, the multitude of Christmas stories can begin to make Christmas crowded and confused, especially for the kids. And when we grow up with all these associations of Christmas, we end up not being able to work out what's the most important, let alone what's true. And when people grow up and they realise that Frosty wasn't actually real and Rudolph didn't really exist, and there was no little drummer boy in history, he certainly doesn't make it to the Bible, it's easy to jump to the next conclusion that the baby Jesus in the manger wasn't real either. And I don't blame people for thinking that. But I'm here today because I want to help you to sort out the Christmas myth and tradition, the fun things that are good to do, but I want you to help sort out the Christmas myth and tradition from the Christmas truth, the Christmas history. Because there is a lot of proof for the original Christmas story in the history books. And if the Christmas story really did happen, then there are some implications for how it changed the world and for how it can change lives as well. So, a bit of hard thinking to do on a Saturday afternoon, but let's get into it. I'm sure you're up for the challenge. You heard the story read just before. What did you think? Is the Christmas story just an exciting tale of ancient prophecies and magicians and kings made up to entertain the children at Christmas time? Well, as I've said already, I don't think so. You see, when I hear it read, the first thing I notice is that Jesus' story begins with a real time, not once upon a time, which is how the TV stories normally begin. Look at the first sentence. It should be printed up here. Now, Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. Now, you could go to the library, or probably just Google it these days, and you'd learn that King Herod ruled from 37 to 4 BC, and there are plenty of records on him because he made a bit of a mark on history for being evil, just as our story here claims. This story actually does have a date. And although it took place in a land far, far away from us anyway, we know where that land is. And not only that, we know where the very town is that it's set in, and you can still go to Bethlehem today. This is what it looks like. This Christmas story has a real location. A friend of mine took that photo when she went on holidays to Bethlehem a few years ago. I think it's a dangerous place to go on holidays, but it's amazing because it does bring these things alive. This is Bethlehem today. Bethlehem is on the map and it's in the history books. This story is just so much more than a made-up tale. It's making claims that actually can be checked out and proven. But why has it been told down through the generations? What's it all about? Will it teach us not to discriminate like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Well, no, not directly. Will it teach us to be good little children? Well, no, again, unless you believe the Christmas carol that tells us that Christian children all must be mild, obedient, good as he. But never mind that. Let's look at the story and see what it's all about. It's actually about three groups of people who were looking for Jesus. First of all, we have the wise men. Look at verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. Now this is classic Christmas carol material. We three kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse afar, field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. I think I have a picture of that. These men had come a long way from the east to look for Jesus. They get there almost 2 years after he was born. It took them that long to travel from their far distant country. Here's another hint of the history behind the legend. If they had really come from afar, as the carol says, they would not have arrived on the very same night. Aeroplanes were centuries away from being invented at that point. And how do we know that they get there two years later? Look at the Bible passage. They arrive at his house, not at the stable. And also at the end of the passage, it talks about the fact that Herod kills all the baby boys who were 2 years old or under. That's how we know that they arrived 2 years later. They saw the star at his birth and they set out to find this king and they searched for 2 years to find King Jesus. The wise men had travelled miles and miles to see the one that had caused a star to appear at his birth, to find the long-promised king. And they brought him gifts, gifts fit for a king, gifts, expensive gifts of gold and incense and myrrh. Ah, Christmas shopping. Sometimes it's just hard to find the right thing, isn't it, for the right person, something that will be really suitable for them. There was the year when my aunt got a little bit mixed up, and she was labelling our Christmas presents to post away, and when we received them, my brother opened a gift of floral shower gel, and my mum got a pair of men's socks. But we knew by the nature of the gifts which was meant for who, and they were able to swap them. Now, the gifts that the wise men brought Jesus also tell us who they were meant for. Let's look at verse 11. Whoops, that one. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Now, these are luxury goods. It's truffles and Christian Dior and, well, gold's still worth a fortune, isn't it? The nature of these gifts tells us that the wise men had searched for Jesus in order to worship him as king. But what about the other king? King Herod. Did you notice the situation? It's a bit awkward, really. The wise men come to the king of the Jews to ask for the whereabouts of the king of the Jews. That'd be a bit like Kevin Rudd ringing up Queen Elizabeth and asking to speak to King Charles. This is bad news for the hearer. She asks, "Have you been speaking to my doctors lately?" King Herod's reign might have been coming to an end. No wonder it says in verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. What an understatement. Had a new king arrived to claim the throne? Herod must have been wondering. He knew his claim to the throne was a bit shaky anyway. He wasn't a direct descendant of the great king of Israel, King David. And he seemed to know, too, that there would be a new king coming at some point in time. Look at verse 4. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. The Christ. King Herod had heard of this man. That was the name given long ago to the ruler that the Jews were expecting, the descendant of King David. Had he now come? And what would happen to Herod? And what would Herod do? Well, we don't have to wait too long to find out, do we? In verse 16, at the end of our passage, it says, "Then Herod, when he saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men." Herod, like the wise men, was also searching diligently for Jesus, but not to worship him, despite what he says. Rather, he wants to kill off the rival claim to the throne. And now we turn to the third group of people. Herod wasn't the only one who was actually disturbed by Jesus' arrival. It says that all Jerusalem was troubled. The Jews had been told that the king might have just arrived, with a star to prove it. And what were they concerned about? Well, most likely they were afraid of the resulting upheaval. Notice the plan to kill all the baby boys. They knew that this was typical Herod-like behaviour. By this stage, and you can read this in some of the history books, Herod had already killed his favourite wife and two of his sons out of paranoia. This man had issues, and I guess the Jews were right to be scared. But these weren't actually ordinary Jews. They were Jewish leaders. They were the ones who were the experts, the ones who can tell Herod where to find the Christ. They were the chief priests and the scribes, and they know their scriptures and they quote them in reply to Herod's question about where to find the Christ. They read, "And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." It looked like their ancient prophecy had just been fulfilled. What an exciting moment in time. Wouldn't you rush to Bethlehem to see it unfold if you'd been there? And yet, what's the response of the Jewish leaders? Apathy. Did anyone go to Bethlehem? Not that we know of. Matthew's story records that it was just the wise men and some shepherds. The Jews' attitude was almost as amazing as the wise men. Why didn't they go to check it out? The wise men had travelled for months to see Jesus. The Jews needed only to travel 5 miles. The wise men knew only of a star that they'd seen in the sky and a prophecy. The Jews knew their whole scriptures, and there was much that was pointing to this event. They knew it all, but they did nothing. They were too scared of what Herod would do. And in some ways, I don't blame them. When I read this Christmas story, it does ring true to me. Not just because several elements in the story are historical, like Herod and the star and the location of Jesus' birth, but also because the people in the story are just like us. Some had a faith that made them travel long distances to see a long-promised and prophesied about king. Some were really evil, like Herod and his henchmen, but most of them were just people living quiet lives, not wanting to be disturbed by a startling piece of news that might just turn their world upside down. And this makes me wonder about us today. See, many of us have known the Christmas story ever since we were old enough to understand it. Maybe our parents read it to us, or maybe we heard it at school or saw it on television. It's been woven into the fabric of our Christmas memories. The story's all around us at Christmas time. There are Christmas decorations everywhere in the shops, even now, I do believe. And we can walk into the churches at Christmas time and we can find out what it's all about. Why are we decorating our town for Christmas? But are we in danger of being just like the Jewish leaders? Their great king was just down the road, but they didn't bother to search for him. Christmas is everywhere in our town, but do many people take time to investigate the claims? The three different responses in our story are quite typical of people today still. Even here, there'll be people who are really seeking Jesus, trying to understand if he really is a king, ready to worship him as king if they find that to be true. Others might already have found him and know that he is king. Others might be like Herod and hate the idea that someone else is claiming to be the king or the boss or our ruler. Now, we don't call ourselves kings and queens. People would rightly think we're mad if we go around saying, well, I'm Queen Alison, thank you very much. But in reality, we all live like it a bit, don't we? We live as rulers of our own little worlds, and we don't really want a rival to our throne. And then there's others who are simply ignoring the king. They want to live a peaceful life, build their houses, work in their jobs, and ignore the Christmas message from year to year. I think this is the norm. But can I urge you that whatever stage you're at the moment, to seek after Jesus this Christmas time. For the Christmas story is only the beginning of Jesus' incredible true story. He's no longer a newborn. He grew up and he died and he was raised to life again. That's the Christian claim. And that's the twist in this Christmas tale. You see, Herod rejected Jesus and he tried to kill him. And in fact, Jesus had come to die. But not yet. This time, in our story, he was rescued. But when he did die, over 30 years later, it's a very significant sign that hung over him when he hung on the cross. It said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." That's at the end of Matthew's Gospel. You can have a look at it there sometime. You see, Matthew's message is that Jesus was born to die for us, so that we could have a fresh start with that king that we've ignored. You see, Jesus didn't just come to be the king of the Jews. He came to be the king of the world. And later on, the Bible tells us that one day Jesus will come back to reign as king, and that there will be a happily ever after ending to this story. The Bible says that everyone who knows Jesus as their king will live forever in his kingdom. But not everyone will live happily ever after in Jesus' story. Herod won't, and neither will anyone who ignores or rejects Jesus' kingship. You see, whether you realise it or not, you're actually a character in this true story. Whether your part does end happily ever after or not does depend on your response to Jesus as your king. Will you accept that he was born to die for you? Or will you continue not to think much about King Jesus and be forever excluded from his kingdom? If this was just a happy Christmas story to entertain the children, it'd be an interesting tale with a happy ending for everyone. But the true Christmas story is a story that does impact all of our futures, and it requires a response. What will be yours this Christmas time? You do need to find out at some stage, was Jesus truly born to be your king? And if so, what does it mean to serve him as king? And what does it mean that he came to die for you? Don't forget to seek answers to these questions this Christmas time. Take some time out to see if the proof of the Christmas story does actually measure up. There's a couple of different ways that you can do this, and one of them is that there's a little pink card at the ends of each of the seats, and you could indicate on there that you'd like to find out a bit more. There seems to be a course that'll be running soon to find out more about Jesus, so that might be something you'd like to do. Don't let the busyness of Christmas preparations get in the way of the meaning of Christmas. Take some time out to find out if the story can be proven, and if it can be proven, what does it have to do with your life?